Welcome to The Break Breakdown. I'm your host, Courtney Romano, and I am so excited to share this interview with you today with filmmaker Joshua Caldwell. Joshua has done so many things, but the most recent thing he's done is Mending the Line, a feature film that he directed with Brian Cox that is out now, and it had a theatrical release, and it's now out on digital, and you can watch that anywhere you rent movies. And one of the most interesting things about this conversation is tracing the line from that film with Brian Cox that was just released to his $6,000 feature film that kicked off his career. This conversation really illuminates how one thing leads to the next and the next and the next, and how if you put yourself out there in small ways, they turn into big ways, and how the practice of making art as a beginning independent artist is the same practice as being, you know, a filmmaker with five feature films under your belt, directing one of our biggest stars of the moment in our culture. Joshua not only has made feature film after feature film and a career as a director, but he also has a course. And the course is called 6K Filmmaker, and it helps you learn how to do is exactly what he did in making a feature film for $6,000. And it feels like we're all kind of building this new model. I think Joshua is a great example of someone doing that really, really well. So I hope you love this interview as much as I loved talking with him. And I won't say too much more. Let's just get right into it. Okay, Josh, welcome to The Break Breakdown. So happy to have you here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I as I mentioned before we started recording, I'm going to treat this interview as me, Courtney Romano, personally interviewing you for all the questions that I have about your career, because it has, from what I can tell, spanned it in almost a linear way, which I would love for you to either disprove or, you know, tell me how correct I am. Either way, I'm so fascinated in seeing what you've built step by step. But before we get into all of that, I want to do something that we've been calling the five up front. So these can be like quick little answers. So number one, film school or no film school?
No film school.
Great. Number two, when did you make your first film?
The first film I ever made was, I was in eighth grade, and it was a 25 minute long film I had to make for a communications class, and it was called Cheese is Good. And it was an adaptation of a short story I wrote in like seventh grade, which was about a detective that was like a block of cheese solving mysteries. And it was just the most ridiculous, preposterous thing ever. And I remember we shot it on VHS, and I was editing it from VCR to VCR. And like trying to take like, so it was a linear edit, and I was taking scenes from like The Rock because there was this whole chase sequence that it was like absurd.
But also 25 minutes, very ambitious for your first film.
Yeah, it was very ambitious. Yeah.
So number three, how many films have you made? You can include that one or not include that one.
Yeah. Gosh, well, I've made five features now. I've done a series for Hulu, which was approximately a film. And then I would say I've done maybe like four or five shorts.
Wow.
I would say that I can think of. There are probably a little bit more than that. But yeah, so that, wow. I don't know, whatever that adds up to.
If anyone says one feature, I'm automatically like, how? I'm so impressed.
Right, right.
Five is like a miracle here on earth. Number four, really intense question. How do you take your coffee?
I take my coffee with heavy cream.
So number five, what's the last thing you read that changed your life?
Last thing that changed my life in a significant way, and people can interpret this however they want, but I read How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. That's the one that's all about psychedelics and like that kind of thing. And that was a very, very life-changing read.
You have just released theatrically, or a couple months ago, I guess, Mending the Line with Brian Cox, yep, which you directed. And now it's out on digital. And people can rent it and watch it that way and buy it. But you started your career, and you please correct me in all the ways that if I get this wrong, but you started your career making the movie The Layover for $6,000. Not only was it a $6,000 feature film, but it was in French.
Right.
And for me, the line from that to Mending the Line, a film about like mental health and veterans and with Brian Cox, that storyline that you've written with your life is so fascinating to me, because it seems to me that it has been linear step by step. But from what I know about my own life, that might not be how it felt. So I guess what I would love for you to do is kind of set the stage right now for our listeners before we go back to The Layover. Like, where are you right now in your career as a filmmaker, as a director and writer?
Funny enough, I'm in a somewhat challenging place. You know, I've been directing full time for the last 10 years. You know, Layover kicked that off for me. And, you know, that's sort of now culminated 10 years later with Mending the Line. And, you know, right now, the biggest challenge is the fact that, you know, this industry is sort of in turmoil. And, you know, I directed a movie that's got, you know, quite a cast, you know, like Golden Globe winners and Oscar winners and things like that, Emmy winners. But it came out at a time when everyone was on strike, you know, and movies were very challenged at the box office. And so even if, like, you know, it had gotten tons and tons of attention, just people in Hollywood are like on vacation. You know, they're just at this point where they're like not really looking, you know, they're just like, well, everyone's on strike. Let's take a break. There's nothing to really do. The way I felt about my career versus how it is perceived from the outside is that I feel like the act of building a filmmaking career is pushing a boulder up the hill. Mm-hmm. Right. And you sort of expect that at periods of time along that hill, like say you make a feature or you make another feature or whatever, that boulder has a place to rest for a second. And then you keep going. The way that I personally felt has been like, I get to that place and the boulder rolls back to the bottom of the hill. And it feels like every project that I've done, even at this stage, is literally like starting with zero momentum again and trying to get that project up the hill. And it's been a discouraging thought, to be honest. Like, it's been a discouraging sort of mental mindset, and I've struggled to find my way out of it. And it wasn't until recently I was talking with a friend, and he was telling me a completely unrelated story about his son, who was wanting to be a vet and was graduating from, you know, college, and sort of talked about how he and his son used to go on hikes, and they would hike this particular mountain here in the Northeast, and they would always reach this point where you sort of felt like you were there or getting close. And what you reached was a false summit. And the false summit then takes you back down. And I clicked with that in a way that said, okay, like maybe what I'm experiencing is not the boulder rolling back down behind me, but is instead just rolling. It's still rolling downhill, but it's rolling downhill off that false summit. And in my case, like, it's been one of those things where it's oddly rare that one film leads into another film. Directly. And mainly because they're probably very different, but also for whatever reason, that just seems to be the path that I'm on. You know, the thing that I've learned about Hollywood, and it was a lesson that I continue to relearn every project I'm on, was the lesson I learned when I won the MTV Movie Award back in 2006. And I was this young kid coming right out of college, to go to the MTV Movie Awards, and I got a golden popcorn, and I got to be on TV, and it was like, oh, they're going to hand the keys to Hollywood to me. I'm the next, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, like whatever. And when that didn't happen, there was like a ton of bitterness, and it didn't happen because of things like outside of my control, right? Like, they didn't, when they released a press release of all the winners after the show, they did not include me in that list. Right. And so nobody really knew that I won, because nobody watches the MTV Movie Awards, you know, and certainly nobody's paying attention to like some, you know, best film on campus college thing. To me, it was a huge deal, but to everyone else, it was not a huge deal. No, I learned very quickly that nobody in Hollywood is going to do anything for you.
Right.
If something's going to happen, it's because you are going to go out and make that happen. And so in that case, I put the movie award under my bed and I got to work and I started hustling and I continue to hustle to this day. So I guess where I'm at, you know, in terms of my career now is I've certainly reached a place where I have an easier time getting financing. I have an easier time connecting with producers. I have an easier time getting cast, but in no way does that make that easy. You know, I'm still working in a sort of area of filmmaking that is, you know, independent financing, you know, very much unfortunately driven by, you know, a similar sort of direct-to-DVD sort of mentality on a lot of these movies. So they're really like, it's cast contingent. Certain cast members are only going to get it done. The movies tend to be action or thriller or horror. And, you know, and so where I'm at is trying to navigate that set, like what that setup is, and do it telling stories that I want to tell. Mm. And sort of going, how can I use, okay, there's a bunch of like requirements and parameters and limitations that exist in this sort of, we'll call it the sub 7 million space, right? Mm-hmm. There's all these parameters and things you have to adhere to. Okay, how do I do that and still tell an interesting, different story?
Okay, so it sounds like the challenges are the challenges at every level. It just depends like which kind of bucket they're falling into. So if you're an independent filmmaker and you've never made a feature film before, you also have financial challenges. You might be like, wow, a $5 million budget would be a dream, right? But like the challenges at a $5 million budget are probably like just, I don't want to say equal, but like in the same wheelhouse as like the challenges at a $0 budget, because at the end of the day, what you're saying is like, I'm trying to get resourced here. So my challenge as a filmmaker is to get resourced, is to get financing, is to make the script solid enough that it can be good, you know, like that it can have a life and it doesn't just like, you know, fall away, you know. All of these challenges. I have a friend, Michelle, who says what you're doing when you're trying to like get up to the next level is you're just asking for bigger problems. Not like in a threatening way, but just like you're asking to up level your problems. So instead of trying to raise $100,000, now you're trying to raise $1 million. It's the same kind of, I want to say like muscularity of the filmmaker at a different, like, along the way. So the boulder is getting heavier, but it's still the same motion of pushing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have different challenges at different budget levels. Like, you know, it's not easier to make a $5 million movie than it is to make a $100,000 movie.
Right.
You know, and people think now it's a lot of money. Well, I can tell you that like the two movies I made that are, you know, well over $1 million came with severely limited schedules, mm-hmm. you know, and a whole host of other challenges that did not necessarily make me feel like, oh, wow, we had a ton more money.
Let's go back to The Layover, which you made in 2014, I think, 2013.
We made it in 2013, came out in 2014.
Okay. I would love for you to set the scene of what your professional life was like before you made that movie. What were you doing? What were your goals? What were you interested in, and why did you make it?
You know, I moved to LA in 2006, like kind of the fall, right after I made the MTV, right after I won the MTV Movie Award. Originally, I wasn't going to move to LA. I was going to stay in Seattle. And then I won the movie award. And I was like, well, I might as well. I mean, if you're looking for like something to indicate maybe you should move to LA, this is probably it. You know, I started doing like music videos and trying to get whatever I could, you know, just do whatever I could. And then the 2007 writer strike hit, and that was like, you know, kind of completely rewrote the industry. And it was like, you know, I managed to do some stuff, but it was nothing was really picking up. I was trying to get a feature going, wasn't getting a feature going. I didn't really understand how to do that. And eventually I was continuing to write. I was continuing to write at night, try to come up with material. And eventually I said, you know what? You know, I was working retail as like a day job and writing at night. I'm like, I don't really want to do this. I'm like, maybe I should just get a job. Maybe I should just try and get a job in the industry as like a development person or what, a creative exec or whatever. Because I'd rather be doing that than you know, working retail. And so I started interning. And I tell you, it was quite a thing to swallow to say, well, I won a movie award and then like be interning for free at like, you know, these various companies. But I just said, fine, like whatever. And I got my foot in the door at a place and I worked there for a little bit and I gave like the assistant my script and it was like this big, stupid comedy. It was like a Will Ferrell comedy, he gave it to his like a friend of his who worked at a company called Guy Walks Into a Bar and they produced Elf. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we love this. We want to develop it. And we were like, oh my God, this is amazing. Meanwhile though, you know, it's no money. So meanwhile, I'm like still interning and I eventually realized that the internship is like not going to go anywhere. Mm. So, I reach out to the guy who had brought over, you know, who had read our script and he was at this other company. I said, hey man, he had recently left Guy Walks Into a Bar. Sort of complicated. Sorry. He eventually landed over at, with Anthony Zeiker. Anthony Zeiker is the creator of CSI. And Anthony started a new development company, production company called Dare to Pass. And my buddy and his boss had just moved over there. And I just said, hey man, like this internship I'm at is not going anywhere. I know you're on a lot. If you ever hear of anything or there's any opportunities, like even as an internship, I'd love to interview for it. And he said, all right, I'll get back to you. And he came back to me and he said, hey, I want you to come in and meet Anthony and the guys. And they needed help with like, I don't know, they had a blog they were doing and like just whatever. But they were like, we need somebody to come do it. And you have a blog. So I was like, all right. I was like, that's cool. I get to go work on a lot, you know? And so I went there and I basically also proved to them that I could edit and I could do a lot of other stuff. And so then they eventually hired me and I started working essentially as the director of digital media. So I was sort of overseeing a lot of the digital work that they were doing. But one of the cool things about it was I got to direct stuff. I got to produce stuff. I got to work with like people like Lexi Alexander and Rob Legato, who's like a 2-time Academy Award winner for visual effects. Like I got to work with some really cool guys and people, you know, like men and women, directors, writers, like ran the whole gamut. But at the same time, this whole time, right, I'm at this job, which is pretty full time. I'm also continuing to write. And I'm reaching a point where I'm starting to feel like, well, what I really want to be doing is directing. Mm-hmm. And I want to direct features. And so I'm either going to continue down this path of being an exec, or I'm going to take a shot. And so I just said, you know, I think I got to make a feature. But I'm at a place where I'm like, what story do I have that's going to justify somebody spending hundreds of thousands of dollars? Like the more money you want, the more requirements that story needs to fit. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and I was never that, right. I wasn't writing super commercial stuff. So what I was doing at Zeiker's was we were experimenting a lot with these digital cameras. We were shooting a lot on like Canon 5Ds and, you know, these had just come out. They were just this like new thing for people to use. And I was using a lot of it. And I was in a situation where I was forced. I was, you know, shooting stuff with this camera and had no resources. Mm-hmm. I had no lights. I had no like, you know, I was given a camera and an actor. It's like, go figure it out. And you're like, all right. And it just was really remarkable to me what you could shoot with this camera, you know, when you were like shooting at high ISOs and how much you could take advantage of the light that already existed in a place. Because up till then it was light everything, takes forever, you know, whatever. And I just was seeing the opportunity in this camera to do something, you know, unique and to shoot something at night. and take advantage of LA. I mean, heavily influenced by like Collateral, right? Like Michael Mann mm-hmm. talking about how he used digital cameras for all the night stuff in Collateral because of the way that you could see so much. And so you go, okay, like this is really interesting. I don't know where that leads me. At the same time, I was hearing a lot of stuff about how Ed Burns was making these like $10,000 features. And I said, well, I can probably get $10,000. Maybe I should write something that I think I could make for $10,000. And so I, over months, had this initial idea of a woman stuck on a layover in LA and didn't know what it was going to turn into. Could have gone anywhere. Could have turned into some thriller, you know, like whatever. And I started watching a lot of like Cassavetes and French New Wave and just became like really influenced by this idea of like, oh, maybe I could just tell this kind of small, intimate story about this woman who's on this journey, and that journey gets interrupted. And she's sort of gifted these 12 hours in LA. And okay, what does that look like? You know, and I was at a point where in my life where I was about to turn 30, and I had said, you know, I really want to make a feature before I turn 30. And, you know, I didn't feel like I was where I wanted to be in my career. And like my wife was pregnant. And so there were a lot of like big life changes coming down the spot. And I took all that things that about myself and used a little bit of my wife's story and wrapped it all up into this story of this girl she's on her way to Singapore. She's traveling from Paris to Singapore. She has a connecting flight in LA, which I don't even know if that's real, but she has a connecting flight in LA. Like, I don't know if you would actually connect in LA.
I was just thinking, you connect in LA. I have no idea.
Like, yeah. You might go the other way. I don't know, right. But you might connect through Beijing. But I was like, you know, she's traveling from Paris to Singapore to visit her boyfriend. She thinks her boyfriend is going to propose, and she's really just not sure if that's what she wants, you know? Mm-hmm. And because she had this whole other life, and she's living in this kind of existential, like, you know, loss of who she was and who she's going to be. And I was just like, all right, that's really interesting. And took a lot of my own, the motorcyclist in it is not me, but I took like elements of me and mm-hmm. put it in there. And anyway, I just started writing and had a script in about 2 weeks mm-hmm. and was like, that was too fast. Like somebody, mm-hmm. there's gotta be something wrong with this.
Right.
Uh-huh. And sent it out to friends and they were like, this is really good. And I was like, are you sure? Cause like, I didn't, you know, and so I think we ended up doing like four drafts, very minor rewrites. And I went to my buddy Travis and I said, hey, would you help me produce this? And he's like, well, how much you want to make it for? And I said, $10,000. And he's like, mm-hmm. all right. So we ended up reaching out to a couple of people. We got $5,000 and I put in an additional $1,000 to make mm-hmm. it six. So that's how we got to the six number. And I shot it. And this is all while I was still working for Zyker. And so mm-hmm. I basically set it up and I said, well, listen, I had all these actors that I had worked with on Zyker projects. Mm-hmm. So I leveraged that. And I went to them and said, do you want to do this movie? And they said, yeah. And I'm like, I can't really pay anything, but we'll do it under SAG and we'll do minimum, whatever. And they said, yeah, sure. They were all like, whatever. And, you know, we set it up with me, Travis, a DP who I'd worked with, and another producer. And it was the four of us. And none of us got paid. And it was like a collective. We all shared in whatever profit, no profits. And everyone knew that. But like, you know, we were all in a place where we wanted to make a feature.
Right.
And have that credit.
Right.
And everybody really liked the story. But the other thing too, was I said, listen, I got a job. So like, if we're going to do this, we have to shoot on weekends. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, that's great. Cause that means I don't have to, that doesn't impact everything else. And so, right. You know, that's what we did. So while I was at Zyker's, you know, I'd finish the week on Friday, I would grab a bite to eat somewhere and I would immediately head to set wherever that was. And we would shoot until 2-3 in the morning. And then I'd go home, sleep, you know, sleep in. And then the next night do it again. And then sometimes even Sunday night we do it and I'd call in late Monday or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's how we made the movie. And, but what I really wanted to do with it, the reason why, you know, and this will come back, circle back around when I talk about the course, but what I really wanted to do with it was I wanted to flip the traditional way of approaching a low budget movie, which is you limit your cast and you limit your locations, right? And you put everything else, all what you're paying for is crew, props, and all the sort of accoutrement that you might want on a film set. And I just said, F all that. Let's just put our money on what's on screen, because it's just going to be four people, sometimes one person. And we already have the camera, we already have the equipment. So, you know, let's put it on screen. And by putting it on screen, what I mean by that was I wrote a story that took place everywhere. I mean, we're, you know, the film opens on an airplane landing in LA. The film then proceeds to go through an airport. Then we're in a hotel. Then we're in clubs. We're on the backs of motorcycles. So like we flipped it. So instead of doing the thing where you have a limited location and limited cast and a big crew, we flipped it. We had minimal crew. And we had a decently sized cast, and we had tons and tons of locations everywhere. As a result, the film feels much, much bigger than the budget suggests, which was always a surprise to me, because I never thought that, like, when I did the movie, I'm like, this is like a small drama. Nobody's going to be impressed that I made it for $6,000. It's not some sci-fi movie or something with effects or anything like that. And yet people just seem to be so enamored by the budget number that it just kind of took on a life of its own.
Paradoxically, these limitations that we think are going to hamper the actual product end up being, again, the obstacle is the way, right? They end up being the way that we can make the best product. You're pulling from different parts of your reality, your day job, your connections, the limitations and the opportunities, both within your day job,
right,
the
right,
limitations right, and opportunities of your life. So it sounds to me like you looked at your reality and said, what can I work with here? And then made the movie.
Yeah. And it, you know, I think that the movie doesn't work also if it's just like, it's a lot of locations and actors, right? Like what people, in a way, I was able to hide that stuff because of the story.
Right.
And because that's what people really connect to. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that always like bothered me when I would work with, and I loved all the DPs I've worked with, so I'm not criticizing them, but constantly I would hear, well, we can't shoot above this ISO. You know, we got to light everything, and otherwise there might be noise in the image. And I'm just going like, but the problem is that the amount of time you need to take to light cuts into the amount of time I need for performance.
Right.
And Layover was the movie that proved to me that performance and story will always trump any technical errors or technical mistakes. Because in Layover, I never once heard anybody ever come up to me and say, I really liked your movie until I saw noise in the image.
Right.
They don't do it. And the reason why I was able to make something that connected with them story-wise was because I had extremely minimal lighting. And oftentimes we would get to a location and we would be shooting in 20 minutes. And I would spend 7 hours shooting. I would do 14, 15, 16 takes of scenes. Performance after performance after performance. I would let the actors like try stuff. We would experiment. We would play. Like, as a result, I had an enormous amount of footage to choose from to craft the best performance. I mean, the actors gave great performances no matter what, but like I was able to pick the best instead of feeling like, well, I only have three takes, so I got to pick the least worst, you know?
Right.
And that was a moment for me that I've tried to carry with me within reason to say, you cannot let the technical impact the story. And if it does, nobody's going to care. Nobody cares how good it looks if they're not connecting to the story. And so that's what was most important, was the ability not only to tell a good story, right, despite your limited budget, to find a story that you can tell on the limited budget that is not going to betray the fact that you had no money, you know, by showing things that clearly are not true. And I'll give you an example of this later, but also just the story trumps all, and it allows you to get away with so much. Like, I personally feel that Layover is a fairly rough film in terms of its visuals. And yet constantly I have people telling me that like, oh, looks great. It's beautiful. Like, you know, you captured LA in such a great way. And I think that what's happening is like the beauty of the story and the way they're connecting the story is actually influencing how they're perceiving everything else.
That's so good.
And and I think the thing that I did right in Layover was I wrote a story that anybody can connect to, because as much as it's about sort of like millennial angst, what that movie is really about is it's about coming to a fork in the road and not knowing which direction to go. And I can't say that that was calculated. It was just sort of me feeling like I'm at a crossroads. I'm either going to direct and pursue a directing career, or I'm not. I'm going to be, and everything then is going to influence how I am as a father and how I am as a husband and what my future looks like and all that kind of stuff. So often the most personal stuff is what becomes the most universal.
Did you have a moment, because you mentioned writing this in 2 weeks, and I have the experience too of when I have an idea, like a couple weeks ago had an idea and wrote 40 pages. And then of course I stopped and was like, damn it,
yeah.
Act 2. But,
but
like I have also in other moments had that feeling of like, it's just flowing, it's coming. And I almost don't trust it. Was there something that you did in the writing process itself? Either maybe some way that you spoke to yourself or some way that you just turned off part of your critical brain, or like what advice would you have based on what you did with Layover?
Layover was a very strange thing for me because I think that I just did like minimal notations. I did not structure anything out. I maybe had a beat sheet, although I can't fully remember, but I knew that like what I did was I kind of took off any restraints, you know, because I kind of said like, you know what, I'm making this for like no money. So like, let me make what I want to make. So, you know, Layover features, and in the script, it like a lot of stuff may not work. It doesn't appear to be something that can work. I mean, there's a 10 page long conversation on, you know, with when she's on the phone with a guy that you don't see in the beginning of the film. And I just sort of said, you know what, I'm just going to write this as I go. And so like the motorcyclist was a discovery. That was not something I planned, which is why he appears so late. But you know, and so I can't, you know, it was so long ago. I don't know if there was anything specific, but what I tried to do was just go, I'm really making this for me. Let me just put it down. Let me just like, you know, vomit it out. All this stuff that's swirling around in my head for the last couple months and these feelings that I have and all this kind of stuff, and not edit myself at this stage. And I was not trusting that it worked to the point where I said, well, somebody else needs to read this to tell me. And and then I would be given the shot to say, well, they say, well, you know, you got 10 pages of dialogue here. And I'm like, yeah, but that's okay. Like, you know, the reason is because of this, right? Like I was having an interesting conversation with one of the students in 6K Filmmaker, and he was saying, you know, he's getting ready to make a feature and make a certain way. And he'd sent his editor, like he sent him the script and the movie to watch. He said, check out like what this guy did. And the editor read the script and he's like, I don't know, man. He's like, I'm not sure about this thing. You know, he's got like super long dialogue. I don't think this works, right? And the director said, just watch the movie. And the editor came back and said, whoa, like, okay, like it works. And he's like, so much so that the editor was reflecting back on scripts he passed on because he didn't feel like they worked in the script stage. And he was regretting the fact that maybe he shouldn't have passed. The point is, we had a lot of discussion about, like, for example, that 10-page, that 10-minute dialogue scene in the beginning of the film. And I just said, you know, here's my thing. My justification for it was we never get to meet the fiance. And the only thing we have is this phone call. So if this is a 3-minute whatever, like, you know, that's not going to impact it. But furthermore, I have had these calls. Right. I've been on these calls and other people have had these calls when like you don't really want to talk and you're not really talking about anything. And there's clearly strain and there's clearly conflict and there, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I just said, if we can get this right and do it at the length that I want to do it, people will stick around for the rest of the movie.
Right.
And they'll buy into the movie. If they can't get through this, then they're not going to enjoy the rest of the movie anyway. Because the conversations don't get shorter as you go on,
right.
You know?
Right.
So, you know, but it's just that kind of thing, which is sort of going, I'm making this in a certain style. I'm making this in a French New Wave style. I'm making this in like whatever. And I'm going to just sort of, this sort of feels right to me and I'm going to stick with it. But I think like in the writing of it, it was really like just trying to make it personal. That's the stuff that is universal that people connect to, that they're going to go, wow, like this is, I recognize that. Not everybody's going to do it, but a lot of people are. And so, you know, it's especially at that stage one, there's no reason not to make it personal and not to bring a lot of yourself into it and not to play and experiment. And if it's, that's what's going to allow you to rip, you know, to get the writing down and to write and not get hampered by everything. Whereas like you're going, well, I'm trying to make something that's commercial and has this and has this and this, this, like you often, those are like roadblocks that get in the way. And I think that if you can take those roadblocks away and just sort of write something that feels true to you in that moment, it could potentially turn into something. Now, the thing that's got to come into play here is how you translate that then to the screen,
you know,
and knowing, well, this is something that may not work as a scene written in a script, but once it's shot, it's going to work, and having that kind of confidence.
And also, I think a director for sure, but a writer-director is constantly just trying to get the movie out of their head and help other people see it so that the other people can make it. Not to say that you don't collaborate. Of course, there's collaboration through and through, but you might have a knowingness in of yourself, this is going to work. And the challenge isn't making it work. The challenge is helping other people see how it's going to work so that you can all like work together, essentially.
Or getting them to come along with you and trust you that it's going to work, because they may still not understand it.
Right.
You know, and often I find that like it's a challenge until you do it, because once you do it and you sort of see the magic of it, you go, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Now I get it. You know? And so, yeah, it's, and it's knowing that, right? Like, I mean, that's the thing is like scripts are, you know, it's hard. It takes experience and practice and some talent, you know, and skill to sort of look at a blueprint for a house and see what that house is going to become. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with the script. The script is 25% of what it ultimately ends up becoming. And you've got, you know, you got to sort of know that, and you got to know not only how are you going to bring in that other 75%, know that it's enough in the script, you know, to just be the 25%.
Right. That you've got that, you've got a foundation, you've got some kind of, you know, structure there, and then you can keep building off of it. Yeah. I think that's why I personally get like super angsty when I get to like act three and everything. Cause I'm like, all right, Court, whatever you're putting down right now is going to be the thing that everything else gets built off of. And I think that there is a lot of pressure there to like get it right in the script. Like you can't just, you know, when people say, oh, we'll fix it on the day or we'll fix it in post, like all of these are lies. It's absolute fantasy. Like it's not going to be fixed, right? Like it's got to be fixed in the script. So it's a lot of pressure. But I think also what you're saying is that's really sticking with me is like there's no reason not to play. There's no reason not in this 25% to not have a little bit of fun, try something. I've deleted 15 pages before and said like, that's not even going in the save copy file. That's just done.
Right.
You know, like that, no one gets hurt in that situation.
But I think like, you know, too, the way to think about it is I think too many people think of writing as you're writing the final draft.
Right.
You know, and so it may be 15 pages of nonsense to get to that 2 pages of brilliance.
Right.
And you got to wade through that, you know? And I think that like nowadays, you know, cause you're not typing on a typewriter or you're not editing, you know, film to film. There's the best thing you can do is experiment. The best thing you can do is take notes that you absolutely disagree with and try them, you know? And that's a lesson I've had to learn. Mending the Line, we were editing, and Mending the Line was the first movie where I had sort of like, multiple storylines, and when and how to thread these storylines was a challenge. And I found myself like trying to find my way through it. And I remember sitting down and I was watching the commentary for Traffic with Soderbergh. And he was talking about how, he was experiencing the same thing. He's like, you know, we had a super long movie. We had all these storylines. And he's like, the middle was just not working. Something about the middle wasn't working. He said, so we came in and we just like started experimenting. And he's like, at one point, he's like, he cut Catherine Zeta-Jones completely out of the film. You know, he's like, obviously, we were never going to do that. But like, let's see what happens. What does that look like? And so I was just like, oh, wow, like, yeah, you can do that. Like, you can like, cut it down to the bone to see what happens. You can't. And so that's how I ended up approaching a lot of the editing with that, was like to the point where I was sending the producers like a new cut of the film every single day. And they were like, you got to slow down. Like, we don't have time to watch this. We don't have time to watch a 2-hour movie every single day. And I said, all right. But the point was, I sort of just said, you know what, let's take the ego out of it. You know, whatever protective nature I feel about what we shot and all that kind of stuff, what I think the story should be. And let's start like experimenting. Like, let's just, because the worst thing that happens is you hit, you know, control Z or whatever. And it goes back to the way you had it. Right. And I think that's the same thing in writing. You know, I think often, and I'm somewhat guilty of this as well, which is that you think, oh, I need to, what I'm writing down is what it's going to be. And, you know, I try to be better about recognizing that I am a better rewriter than I am a writer. And so to rewrite, though, especially if it's something that I'm working on my own, I need a draft to work off of. So you know what? I got to put on my writing hat and, you know, basically get something down to the point where, you know, if I'm not feeling what this scene is turning into, I will literally like start to just describe what I want it to be in the script and move on.
Right.
You know, right. And then come back to it. I mean, there are times where I'm like, several scripts of mine have just bolded paragraphs of like, well, this is what it's going to be.
Yes.
And I'll come back to it.
Yes.
Because I don't want to get held up there in terms of perfection. I also know that every time I go through the script, every time I rewrite it, every time I read it, new ideas come forward. Mm-hmm. And it's really just about like getting something down, you know, even if it means in your third draft, you're like, you know what? I'm going to scrap the entire third act because now I have a better idea. And I think that if you can be, you know, like less protective of like, oh, what I write down is written in stone and I can't ever change it, then you open yourself up to just what might come down the line. But sometimes you need something there, right? Because if you're facing a blank page, which is like one of the scariest things for me and one of the hardest things for me, there, like you said, there's pressure to come up with something, to get it right, to do whatever, instead of going, you know what, I can write a pile of shit because nobody ever has to read it.
Right.
Nobody ever has to see it. And if that's what's going to allow me to come back and go, okay, you know what, out of like 20 of these pages, one of these pages is worth it and good, but that gives me an idea for the other 19 that I need.
Right.
That's the work. That's the work that like people don't understand happens behind the scenes, you know?
We only have a little bit of time left, but I want to ask, because I think for people who listen to this podcast, they are, you know, maybe they've made something, probably they haven't, but they're in the middle of making something, or they've made a little something and they want to make more. What did you feel like happened after Layover for you? So it was your first feature film. And I know that we talked earlier about thinking all the time, this is going to be the thing, you know, that I don't know, opens the doors to Oz or so. I don't even know what we, as the general, we thinks the goal is sometimes. I'm like, are we sure we know what we want? But I guess either tangibly, externally, or what it did for you as a filmmaker or what it did for you in your life, I'm wondering for people who might say like, okay, I'm going to make a $6,000 feature film. Like, I can do this. What was it like for you on the other side of that?
Yeah, I mean, so we made the film, we premiered it at Seattle International Film Festival. It was nominated for the Pfeiffer-Shee New American Cinema Award. And, you know, it was funny because, you know, I thought it was going to be like this festival darling. Again, like these kind of expectations that you have. I was like, think about it. It's like a French New Wave. It's all in French, like, you know, and it was just something where I thought, okay, this maybe would turn into like a festival thing, right? But we premiered at Seattle, which was great. We got some good press off of it, and things like that. But we never really got a distribution deal. And so then we ended up saying, well, maybe we didn't really get into any other festivals, to be honest. And so then we said, well, maybe we'll do, why don't we self-release it rather than sort of going through these aggregators? So we did that. And around the self-release, we hired for a month, we hired a PR agent. And we said, get me articles. And I wrote a bunch of articles for like The Wrap and No Film School and like all these publications. And we connected with Slash Film because David Chen, who's a critic there or was a critic there, saw the movie at Seattle and really loved it and really supported it. And so we did a lot of like, you know, we pushed it out there when we did the self-release. The result was that a lot of people in Hollywood heard about this movie that got, and I'm not saying everybody, I was not invited to Paramount, but like enough people heard about it and they were like, oh, look, this guy made a feature film for $6,000. Like we should meet him. So we, you know, water bottle tour, met people, you know, but I met a guy, I'd known a guy at my previous work, who we did a project with when I was with Zyker, and he saw Layover and was really impressed. And he hired me to make this show called South Beach. To direct the show called South Beach, which was going to be on Hulu. And so the, I mean, I can go into detail, but basically like, and then another exec who was at, Mar Vista had seen, Layover and really loved it. And I met with her and pitched on a project and didn't end up getting it. But then said, well, you know, after I did the Hulu series, I was like, hey, I've got this idea, for Negative, which was my third feature film. And I said, hey, I'd love to do this movie, but I only want to do it for $100,000. And I want to make it in the same way I made Layover. And they said, sure. So then I did that. And so like, I mean, I'd say that like the three projects, which was my second feature, the Hulu series, then my third feature, Negative, all directly came out of Layover. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, I mean, it was certainly life-changing. It was not something where suddenly I'm like, you know, Hollywood's darling and I'm blowing up, but it was like this slow, like you had said, kind of when we first got on this slow linear process of going from a $6,000 feature and then doing like, I did like it was like a $750,000 feature and then a $1.5 million Hulu series. And then like dropping back down to $100,000 because I was so frustrated by the way that those other two features went, you know, again, things don't get better on the $750,000 feature. I was given 12 days to shoot a feature film, which was like absurd. Now I made Layover in 11, but I made Layover in 11 a very specific way. And the way they wanted to make this movie was a much more traditional budget crew type of scenario. And I'm just like thrust into this, like, you know, 12 day thing. Even the Hulu series was shot in like 15 days. And I just said, this is like, I don't like this. Like, this is not conducive to getting good performances, not conducive to making good stuff. And so Negative was me going, I want to invert it, right? I'm going to take less money, but now I'm going to get more time. Mm-hmm. And so to this day, Negative, which was my $100,000 feature, is the most shooting days I've ever had on a project, which was 37 or 38.
Wow.
And that was done in the same way we made Layover. Super small crew. I would say 80% of Negative was shot with 20% of the budget. Mm-hmm. And then we took the remaining 80% of the budget and put that into the last 20% of the film. So the film feels big. It's got fight scenes and shootouts and we're in desert and we're all over the place. And, you know, we're in Arizona and all this kind of stuff. But it's because we shot so much of it with like a crew of me, one other guy and a sound guy. And that was it, you know? And so Layover definitely led to all these other projects and all these other jobs, which those jobs then led to the other ones and so on. And so, you know, but I think that, the misconception that people have, which is also why, you know, I ended up creating the course, was people think, oh, I just need to make a movie and get a distribution deal and Hollywood's going to come calling. And they do. They talk to me all the time. They're like, you know, I don't understand. Like my movie was on Amazon, you know, I got a distribution deal, whatever. How come I'm not getting opportunities? And I said, because Hollywood's not going on to Amazon and seeing who got distribution deals.
Right.
You know, Hollywood doesn't know you exist. Like, you know, and so you have to be like, I got jobs off a Layover on a self-distributed film.
Right.
You know, well, why? Because the right people knew about it. You know, like, it doesn't matter if some guy in Kansas watches your movie. Like, he's not the one hiring you.
Right. And it's one of those things I've talked with my friend before, who's an actor, who says, like, I don't need to get in front of a million people. I need to get in front of the right one person. Right,
one person. I think that, like, one way to think about that, which might be appealing to your listeners, is that idea of rejection, right? Like, because one, you're going to face it over and over and over again. And I heard a great, you know, analogy or whatever it was. I don't think it's a true story, but it was a great way of framing it, which was, there was a story of this woman who was she's like a real estate agent, right? And she was having trouble selling a house. It had been on the market for months, and she just wasn't getting the interest and wasn't getting the a buyer. And she was complaining about it to her boss. And her boss said, well, like, how many offers do you need to get before you find somebody that works, you know, and buys the house? You know, and she said, I don't know, like, maybe it's like 30 per house. And he said, well, how many do you have now on this one? She's like 11. And he's like, all right, well, it sounds like you need to get out there and get more no's, right? Or what?
Right.
How many no's do you need before you find the yes on the house?
Right.
Sounds like you need to get out and get more no's. So now that flipped my thinking from, oh, it's a rejection. Now, you know, catastrophizing the whole thing. Now nothing's going to happen, to going, oh, that's just another no on my way to a yes.
Right.
You know, and so, like, when a cast, you know, member says no, when a financier says no, you're like, all right, great. Like, that out of the way.
Right.
Not them anyway. You know, let's continue to go get the no's until we get to our yes. And so it turns it from this, like, passive something you experience to, like, a very active process of soliciting the rejections. Right. So that you can get through those to get to your yes.
Yeah. When I was an actor, right at the beginning, when I was right out of school, I used to I had a spreadsheet of every audition I went on, and I'd mark the callbacks and I'd mark the jobs that I got so that I could figure out what my ratio was. And then once I figured out, like, what my percentages were, I was just like, let's just try to get those percentages. And I think it's a little bit more straightforward in talking about, like, the real estate agent or the acting, right? Because as a filmmaker, you can be rejected in all kinds of ways, right? But each thing that you're trying to do, each, like, you know, like, connection, financing, casting, even crewing up, all of these things you can calculate towards, like, you know, all, if any rejections happen in that time, they're all moving you closer to the goalpost.
Right. Well, and also, you just, you know, Hollywood's got a short memory. Mm-hmm. And just a rejection today is not a rejection tomorrow. That doesn't mean you go back with the same thing. The point is that people are not rejecting you.
Right.
They're rejecting a whole amalgam of things that are just not in your favor at that moment. But things can definitely change.
Right.
And, you know, as a writer, no project ever really dies. As a director, no project you're developing ever really dies, you know? And so it just means not now, which isn't easy. You know, because sometimes you need it right now. Like, you need the work, or you want the work, and you're hungry and it feels that way. But, like, you know, there's also that concept of sort of the regression to the mean, right? Like, the idea that, you know, over time, you're going to regress back to the mean of, like, between yeses and nos, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And at first it might feel like no, 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 no. But eventually it is going to turn into a yes. Continually trying to improve my sort of mental, my mentality around this job. You know, you're just out there getting your nose, you're working through stuff, you know, all that kind of stuff has been one of the big things that keeps me going, keeps me looking for projects, because you just don't know. I mean, the way Men in Line came to me was a total freak occurrence, you know, it had nothing to do with me other than I happened to be managed by a guy who made a movie that took place in Montana, but didn't shoot in Montana. And that was started the whole thing.
Right.
And so, you know, continuing to put yourself out there, continuing to get yourself known in whatever way you can, continuing to develop and find projects and either create those projects yourself, to shoot, to do whatever you can, especially early on in your career, all that stuff's going to continue to start to add up and add up to something that will eventually, you know, have you seeing opportunities that you wouldn't have thought you'd be getting 5-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Well, Josh, where can people watch all of your stuff? Mending the Line, Layover, where should they go?
Pretty much everywhere. I mean, I think, you know, iTunes is probably a good haven for it now. It's on iTunes, Amazon, you know, anywhere, anywhere you would normally buy or rent your film. I think Layover is on Tubi, right now. I think Negative and Infamous might also be on Tubi. But honestly, like the best thing I'd say is like, if you Google the title, it always gives you the list of where you can watch it either for paid or for free.
Yeah.
But it, you know, obviously if you get it on iTunes, I get like 30 cents. So, you know.
Well, we will put all of the links to your work and everything in the show notes. And I also will put in to the show notes the link to your course, 6K Filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, we kind of touched on it, but if you want to just give a quick little.
Yeah, I'll give a little. I'll give a plug for it. I mean, so for 10 years, people have been, even to this day, people come up to me and they say, how did you make Layover? Like, I don't understand how you made it for $6,000, you know, and whatever. And so, and you got a career off of it. And so I decided to create a course because I saw that a lot of courses out there were only teaching you how to edit, how to do cinematography, how to color, you know, whatever. But nobody was really teaching you how to make a micro budget film, but to make it in a way that is sort of unique and makes it feel much bigger than the budget you had. There are tons of resources out there for people, you know, you can get it for free, but like, then that's a discipline that you have to go seek out that. So what I did was I took the experience I had making Layover, making Negative, and even applying a lot of the same principles that I made, that I have, to bigger budgets, right? So these are skills, the skills I learned making Layover, I've carried with me on every project. And it's made me a better filmmaker. And so I put together this course, and it takes you sort of through, you know, beginning to end. We talk about mindset. We talk about developing an idea to work for a micro budget, how to write using what I call a modular storytelling technique, using techniques like live environment filmmaking. I take you through production, micro budget cinematography, distribution, marketing, sort of the whole soup to nuts approach. It is not a filmmaking 101. I don't teach you about how to use a lens or an aperture. It's usually, it's best for people who are probably like, they've made shorts, music videos, they understand filmmaking from a technical perspective, but they're stymied by the fact that they're feeling like they need a budget of hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars to make a feature. And instead, I'm trying to show them that there's a different way to do it that, you know, is such a minimal investment that there's almost no risk. You know, it's great. We have like hundreds of students. I've been running it for a few months now. I've had several students now actually make features this way, which is really cool to see. And I would just say anybody that's like, you know, looking for a different approach to micro budget filmmaking and could use guidance on the whole thing, definitely check it out. So it's called 6K Filmmaker. You go to 6kfilmmaker.com/enroll. It's a $97. The other cool thing is you get access to me. So I do like weekly Q&As, and that's not going to last forever. As soon as I have like, you know, tens of thousands of students, I may not be able to do that. So definitely take advantage of it now. And if you think you're right for it, then come join us.
Well, thank you so much, Josh. This was great. I feel like I got so much good practical and, you know, thoughtful mental information for being a filmmaker, and really appreciate you having you being on.
Yeah, it was a great time. It's nice to talk more generally about the world of filmmaking rather than just like a specific movie, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, tell us about Mending the Line. What was it like working with Brian Cox? Like, I've become far more interested, especially with podcasts, in talking a little bit more about like the career and sort of the mindset and like a lot of that stuff, because I think that's actually much more fascinating. You know, again, you may not take everything from what I said, but if you take that one thing, right? And then you take another thing from somewhere else, it can really add up in a big way. So, you know, I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm glad you responded. And it was a lot of fun to chat with you.
Thanks for listening to today's bonus episode of The Break Breakdown. If you haven't already, sign up for the Queen's Bird List, a weekly digest curated for curious, creative, ambitious minds making indie art. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes. And you can follow us and find us on social at Queen's Bird Films and at The Break Breakdown. Season 3 of The Break Breakdown is made possible through the generous support of Eddie and Wendy Shaw. Special thanks to Craig, Elle, and Ren Hansen. You can watch Kinsley Versus now on YouTube, and The Break Breakdown is a project of Queensbird Films.